So the scripture reading today is found in Ecclesiastes 2. I said to myself, go ahead, I will test you with pleasure, enjoy what is good. But it turned out to be futile. I said about laughter, it is madness, and about pleasure, what does this accomplish? I explored with my mind how to let my body enjoy life with wine and how to grasp folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom, until I could see what is good for people to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. I increased my achievements. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself and planted every kind of fruit tree in them. I constructed reservoirs of water for myself from which to irrigate a grove of flourishing trees. I acquired male and female servants and had slaves who were born in my house. I also owned many herds of cattle and flocks, more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. I also amassed silver and gold for myself, and the treasure of kings and provinces. I gathered male and female singers for myself, and many concubines, the delights of men. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also remained with me. All that my eyes desired, I did not deny them. I did not refuse myself any pleasure, for I took pleasure in all my struggles. This was my reward for all my struggles. When I considered all that I had accomplished and what I had labored to achieve, I found everything to be futile and a pursuit of the wind. There was nothing to be gained under the sun. Then I turned to consider wisdom, madness, and folly, for what will the man be like who comes after the king? He will do what has already been done. And I realized that there is an advantage to wisdom over folly, like the advantage of light over darkness. The wise man has eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I also knew that one fate comes to them both. So I said to myself, what happens to the fool will also happen to me. Why then have I been overly wise? And I said to myself that this is also futile. For just like the fool, there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man, since in the days to come, both will be forgotten. How is it that the wise man dies just like the fool? Therefore, I hated life because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for everything is futile and a pursuit of the wind. I hated all my work that I labored at under the sun because I must leave it to the man who comes after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will take over all my work that I labored at skillfully under the sun. This too is futile. So I began to give myself over to despair concerning all my work that I had labored at under the sun. When there is a man whose work was done with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and he must give his portion to a man who has not worked for it, this too is futile and a great wrong. For what does a man get with all his work and all his efforts that he labors at under the sun? For all his days are filled with grief, and his occupation is sorrowful. Even at night, his mind does not rest. This too is futile. There is nothing better for man than to eat, drink, and enjoy his work. I have seen that even this is from God's hand, because who can eat and who can enjoy life apart from him? For to the man who is pleasing in his sight, he gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy, but to the sinner he gives the task of gathering and accumulating in order to give to the one who is pleasing in God's sight. This too is futile and a pursuit of the wind.
Yeah, he says we need that. He says if we don't have that, if we knew that the human race was going to die out not long after we die out, then we wouldn't really give ourselves to the eradication of poverty and disease. Why bother? We wouldn't fight against the things that afflict human beings, we would just sort of give up and have a sense of hopelessness. He actually referenced P.D. James's The Children of Men. If you've seen that movie, that's or read the book, that's the scenario in the film. In the film, humanity has stopped having babies. And the people in the story, they stop, not only do they give up fighting poverty and disease, but they give up even the mundane, everyday things. They give up listening to music. They give up reading books. They give up being intimate with each other. They give up eating good food and drink. And Samuel was saying, if we knew that we were all going to die tomorrow, even the simple things that seem to offer immediate gratification would lose their allure and their power. But in Ecclesiastes, the teacher says even the idea that there are going to be generations after us is still not enough. He says, yeah, there will be generations after us, and so it's somewhat worth it to fight for them. He says, but really, every generation that comes after us is still going to die anyway. The best we can achieve is that they'll live a little bit longer and they'll live a more enjoyable life, but ultimately death comes to everybody. Nothing we do lasts and nothing ultimately matters. Last week when we were talking about Tolstoy, right, this was the crisis that Leo Tolstoy encountered. He looked at the meaninglessness of the universe and he said, what will come of what I'm doing today or shall do tomorrow? What will come of my whole life? Why should I live? Why wish for anything or do anything? Is there any meaning in my life that the inevitable death awaiting me does not destroy? The fact that he was going to die robbed him of all joy and all meaning. You might be thinking, I'm so glad I came tonight. Warm, fuzzy feelings. But this is the thing, that the teacher isn't all doom and gloom, because he's presenting one way of looking at life. But for the teacher, there's actually another way of looking at life. For the teacher, this life isn't all that there is. And for the teacher, there is a God, and not just any God, not a vague, ambiguous deity up there who created everything. For him, there's a God who is personal, who intervenes in human history, who's guiding human history, who has a goal for all things, who sits on a throne and is in control, but not just a God who's all-powerful, but a God who's also all-loving and who cares about people. And he says, if this is real and if this is true, then life is doable and life is endurable and there can even be great joy. And the question that the teacher asks in the passage tonight is, can anything in this world truly, lastingly satisfy us? Can anything in the here and now, he says life under the sun, can anything in the here and now truly, ultimately satisfy us? And we might say, well, there's lots of things that bring me joy, lots of things that bring me happiness. When we talk about satisfaction here, we're talking about a satisfying of that deep, yearning, longing, that ache that we have within us, that there's something more than just what we see in front of us, than just what we touch, than just what we smell. There's something far, far more than this. There's that ache, I think, that's in each and every one of us. And sometimes we're able to very quickly distract ourselves with more social media and more Netflix and more Amazon Prime and with shopping or with drinking or whatever. We're able to very quickly distract ourselves. But sometimes I think we have those moments where the world just sort of stops and we're by ourselves and we're left with our thoughts and we're like, is there more? And we know, we have this sense that there must be, or at least we hope that there is. And the teacher's saying, is there anything in this life that can satisfy that ache, that longing, that yearning? And so the teacher, last week I went into why I don't actually think Ecclesiastes is written by Solomon. So you have to go back and listen to that one. It'll be available soon. But you got to go back and listen to that one to hear why I think that. But the teacher, at least in this chapter, steps into the shoes of Solomon. He pretends to be Solomon. Solomon was the wisest, wealthiest, most powerful king in Israel's history. And he says, look at the life of Solomon. Solomon was a guy who had everything. I mean, if anybody was able to be satisfied with the things of this world, it would be Solomon, wouldn't it? And so he steps into the shoes of Solomon, and he speaks as Solomon. And he says this, so he's speaking as Solomon now. He says, I wanted to know, is it possible to be satisfied with the things of this life? And in the passage Faye read, right away the answer is no, but then Solomon goes on to elaborate on what he did. Solomon says, I built luxurious accommodations for myself. I had multiple homes, and not your average house. I had palaces, and I had them all over the country. I had the place where I wintered, and the place where I summered, and the place where I springed, and the place where I falled. Right? And I had all these homes and all of these palaces. I remember visiting a cottage with some friends, and we took a tour of the lake. And I was looking at some of the cottages on this lake, and some of these cottages were nicer than any home I could ever dream of owning. Right, and that was where people spent 3 months of the year, and then they shut it all down and went back to their city home. Some of those cottages had, guest houses. And the guest houses were even nicer than any home I could dream of owning. And Solomon's like, I had that, an abundance of that. I had multiple homes. I had gardens I could go walking in. I had vineyards. I had parks. He says, I had hundreds of servants, hundreds of slaves, so many slaves that my slaves were marrying each other and having children. There were people born into slavery in my home. It's shocking, it's horrible to hear, but he's saying, I was a powerful man. I never did anything for myself. I had people to do everything for me. Never had to clean my own clothes. Never had to make a meal for myself. Never had to clean up all the things I owned. I didn't build them, and I didn't maintain them. Other people did it for me. And whatever I wanted, they did. They had no choice but to say yes to me all the time. He had absolute power. He says, I amassed silver and gold for myself, the treasures of kings and provinces. And if you actually read in 1 Kings 10, 14 to 25, it lists all of the things that Solomon had, and it's an incredible list. I don't have time to read it now, but it's a wild list. In there he says, everything I owned, or not everything I owned, but most of what I owned, I overlaid with gold. It's like I covered things with gold. I covered my throne with gold, my tables, my chairs with gold. I mean, what's the point of covering something with gold other than to show the world, look at how wealthy I am? And we might think, oh, those primitive people back then. No, people do this now. They overlay the weirdest things with gold. A Hong Kong jeweler I was reading spent $3.5 million building a bathroom made entirely of gold and precious jewels, including a 24-karat solid gold toilet. Now, why? That nothing dignified happens in a bathroom. Nothing dignified happens on a toilet, and he's covering it with gold like it's something special. And he is able to claim still to this day the Guinness World Record for the world's most expensive bathroom. That's something to talk about, I guess, at parties. I don't know. Mike Tyson, good old Mike Tyson, spent $2.2 million on a 24-karat bathtub. He bathes in gold. All right, so people are doing this even today. It's not something that just happened in the empires of old. Solomon said, I covered everything with gold. Solomon says, I had my own personal zoo full of exotic animals. And I thought, again, those primitive people. But no, people do this today. Pablo Escobar. Now, he didn't come by his money, honestly. But Pablo Escobar, at the height of his wealth, he had a private zoo with 200 animals in it, including elephants, ostriches, zebras, camels, and giraffes. Many of them were smuggled in on his drug planes. And this is not relevant to the sermon, but I found it interesting that after his death in 1993, most of the animals were transferred to zoos, but they left the hippopotamuses. And the hippopotamuses started to multiply like crazy and attack people and damage farms. And so these guys had to go in and castrate all the male hippopotamuses. It's not relevant to the sermon. I was just like, life is funny sometimes. But anyway, right? He's like Pablo Escobar. He had his own personal zoos. He says, I gathered male and female singers for myself. It would be like if your friend comes to you and is like, let's go see the Foo Fighters. And your friend was like, how about I just hire the Foo Fighters to come to my house and play for me and you? And you're like, okay. That's what he was able to do. He was able to hire musicians, hire bands to play exclusively for him all day, every day. If he wanted to be entertained, amused, he just snapped his finger and there was some talented person in front of him able to entertain him. He says he has many concubines, the delights of men. He surrounded himself with beautiful women and women that existed only for him and for his needs. We read that Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines, 1,000 women in his household. That rivals Hugh Hefner. I like the way one translation puts it. King Solomon was obsessed with women. He says this, I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. All that my eyes desired, I did not deny them. I did not refuse myself any pleasure. He says, I looked at what there was, and if I wanted it, I took it. Says, I had absolutely everything. And then in verse 11, it reads like he just one night went out on his balcony, right? After a feast, after a party, he just went out on his balcony and he looked over everything that he owned and everything that he had, and his reaction was empty. It's all empty. He says, I found everything to be futile in a pursuit of the wind. There was nothing to be gained under the sun. He said, happiness, satisfaction, joy, with all kinds of different women, with gold, with silver, with zoos, with palaces, with servants, covering everything with gold. He says, trying to get happiness this way is like chasing after the wind. You can't catch the wind. You can't corner the wind. You can't hold the wind. It's futile. It's empty. He says, so you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to turn to wisdom instead. I can't get anything out of stuff, so I'm going to turn to wisdom. He says, I'm going to learn. I'm going to give myself to study. I'm going to study what is a just, moral, good life look like, and then I'm going to live that life. And he says, it is better to live a good life than to live a bad life. He says, psychologically, emotionally, for other people, for your chances of living longer maybe, he's like, it's better to live a good life than a bad life. But he says, at the end of the day, it's still all futile. He says, because the wise person dies and the fool dies. They both die. Death comes to both of them. Right? The person who lives selflessly and righteously dies, and eventually all memory of them fades and is gone. The person who lives immorally and selfishly dies, and the memory of them fades and is gone. He says the same end comes to both of them. There can't even be lasting satisfaction and joy in learning and living well. He's like, selfless living is hard. It's painful. It requires vulnerability. It requires sacrifice. And none of these things come to us naturally. And he's like, and why live that way if you're going to end up the same way as the guy who doesn't care and lives however he wants? Now, a lot of people have come up with reasons for why, even if the universe is meaningless, you should live a good life. But I feel like none of them really have, ultimately, any teeth. If you decide not to care, it doesn't ultimately make a difference. And maybe you feel that way this evening. You're like, I am busting my butt trying to be a good person. And ironically, the people around me that don't give a rip are living even better than me. Their life is going more smoothly than mine. Solomon goes on to lament that everything he's built is going to be inherited by somebody who didn't earn it. He's like, I worked hard for this, and it's going to go to my kids. And my kids haven't done anything. They haven't earned this. And he says, and ultimately, everything that I have, it might end up in the hands of a fool. It might end up in the hands of somebody who's going to make all kinds of terrible decisions, and they're going to lose it all. I've spent years amassing all of this, and they could lose it all. They could be headstrong and think, I'm going to conquer the world and go up against empires stronger than them, and they're going to lose it all. And he says, this keeps me awake at night. This stresses me out. I can't sleep. And he says, I came to a place where I hated my achievements. He had no joy in his work, and he had no joy in the fruits of his work. He says, I hated all my work at which I labored under the sun. And maybe that's you tonight. You're like, why in the world am I pouring myself out at my job, my colleagues, my bosses? Don't care. I'm pouring myself into a company that doesn't care. Surrounded by slackers. Surrounded by incompetent people. Why am I trying so hard? He says, I had no lasting joy and pleasure, no lasting joy in wisdom and learning, and no lasting joy in my work. And yet there was still this yearning and this longing for more. And maybe that's where you're at this evening. You're like, yeah, I've tried pleasure, and I've tried to have fulfillment through my work, and I've tried to have fulfillment through stuff and through things and through people and through learning, and there's still this longing and there's yearning for more. In John chapter 6, there's a story of Jesus. He performs an incredible miracle. He feeds 5,000, it says men, so there were probably lots of women and children there as well. So he feeds over 5,000 people with only 5 loaves and 2 fish. He's able to somehow miraculously multiply these loaves and these fish and feed everybody. to the point where everybody is absolutely full and there's still leftovers. And the people are flabbergasted, obviously, and it said that they chased after Jesus and they wanted to make Jesus king. We've got an election coming up. If one of the guys who wanted to be prime minister, or if Elizabeth May wanted to be prime minister, and they were able to feed absolutely everybody to complete satisfaction and still have leftovers, we would elect that person. We would make that person prime minister. We'd probably make that person king of the world. And that's what this crowd is trying to do with Jesus. This guy could feed us forever. We'll never go hungry. Make him king. And Jesus responds, "Don't work for the food that perishes, but for the food that lasts for eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you, because God the Father has set his seal of approval on him." Now, obviously, Jesus isn't saying, don't bother working and trying to feed yourself. He's using bread as a picture. He's using bread as a picture of what is impermanent, temporary, finite. He's saying, stop laboring, trying to squeeze ultimate satisfaction out of finite, impermanent, temporary things, because those things and those people, they can't give it to you. Jesus says, you were made for something more, something eternal, something everlasting, something infinite, something unfailing, something unceasing, a joy, a satisfaction, a happiness, a pleasure that things in this life are only a picture of, but are not ultimately. There's a quote up on the screen by C.S. Lewis. He says, "If I find in myself desires which nothing in this world can satisfy, the only logical explanation is that I was made for another world." And that's what Jesus is saying here. You were made for more than just what you can see and taste and touch. You're made for more than just his life. And he says, God the Father actually sent me into the world to give you this more eternal bread that fills, that satisfies, that never runs out. And he says, work for that food. And it's like, okay, how do I work for that food and how do I work for that bread? The crowd asked the same question. What can we do to perform the works of God? They asked. And Jesus replied, this is the work of God, that you believe in the one he has sent. I am the bread of life, Jesus told them. No one who comes to me will ever be hungry, and no one who believes in me will ever be thirsty again. Jesus makes an astonishing claim here. He says, that eternal bread, I'm that bread. In me, I'm the one who can provide everlasting satisfaction and joy and happiness and pleasure. That's an incredibly, incredibly bold statement. At Christianity Explored on Friday night, we were talking about how you can't really call Jesus a good teacher or a good person. Like, you can't leave it at that. Either Jesus is who he said he is, or he's dangerous. Some of the things he says are so bold and off the charts that he would be spectacularly misguided if he was wrong, and he would even be dangerous, and you wouldn't want to follow somebody like that. You wouldn't want to say of somebody like that, well, they've got some good teachings, they're ethical. No, they're dangerous. They're wild. We would think Jesus was a madman. We can't really sit on the fence about Jesus. Either he is who he is, who he said he is, or he isn't. Jesus is claiming here in this passage to be God. And he's saying that unbreakable joy happens in a union, a relationship with God. We were made for God. We were made for this infinite, eternal, everlasting God. And only he can satisfy us. Only he can fill us up. We need a relationship with him. And Jesus is saying, I'm God in the flesh. You need me. And he says, not only do you need me, you need the Father and you need the Holy Spirit. Christians believe in this thing called the Trinity, that there's one God who eternally exists in three distinct persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. It's complicated. But each person is fully God, and Jesus is fully God here in the flesh, and he's saying, I can satisfy you, but I can also bring you into an unbreakable union and communion with the Father and with the Holy Spirit, and they can satisfy you, and this is what you were made for. And the Father actually sent me into the world to restore you to God. To restore you to God. Sin for Jesus is living without reference to God. We've tried to squeeze out of created things what we can only get from the Creator. We've rejected God. We've told him he isn't enough. Maybe not in words, but with our actions. We've denied him. We've devalued him. We've disobeyed him. We've grieved him. And in the process, we've fallen short of who we were made to be, and our world has fallen short of what it was made to be. In the Old Testament, there's a prophet named Jeremiah, and he says, we've hewn out for ourselves broken cisterns. I'm sure many of us are not hewning cisterns in our everyday life right now, so what in the world does that even mean? In Palestine, at the time of Jeremiah, cisterns were dug out of limestone rock, and they were porous, and so you had to line them with plaster so that the water wouldn't leak through, and people would catch rainwater in these cisterns and drink from them. And Jeremiah is saying, what we've done is we have dug out these porous cisterns that can't hold water. He says, we are trying to find joy and satisfaction in things that can't give it to us. These cisterns we have, they're porous and they leak. And there's an everlasting fountain right there waiting for us, and we just ignore it and try to get everything we can out of these porous cisterns. Jeremiah says that's how humanity lives. We've got God and joy and satisfaction right there, but we're like, no, money, possession, sex, power, these things will give it to us. Douglas Copeland, in his book Life After God, he's telling the story of traveling with his daughter. And on this tour that they're doing together, he starts telling her all of these stories about these anthropomorphic animals who were supposed to live a certain life, and things didn't work out, and they ended up living a very different life. And in the middle of one of the stories, he stops. He can't tell the end of the story. And his daughter turns to him and says, "What, Daddy, what?" And he says, "Nothing, baby," I said, stopping myself then and there, feeling suddenly more dreadful than you can imagine, having told you about these animals, filling your head with these stories. And I love this line, stories of these beautiful little creatures who were all supposed to have been part of a fairy tale, but who got lost along the way. And I feel like that's what Jesus says about humanity. We were made for this real life fairy tale of life with God, but we've gotten lost along the way, and we're not living the way that we were supposed to. And Jesus says, I've come to set everything to rights. I've come to pay the penalty for everything that you've done against God and against yourself and against others. I've come to restore you to God for forever. And we might ask, okay, so how do I work for it? Is it coming here? Is it singing these songs? Is it taking communion? Is it getting baptized like we're just going to see? Are these the things that I have to do to get this forever union with God? And Jesus says, no. What Jesus says is simply this. Believe in the one that the Father has sent. He says, no one who comes to me will ever be hungry, and no one who believes in me will ever thirst again. Jesus says, if you want this forever life with God, turn away from the life that you've been living and entrust yourself to me. That I am who I say I am, and that I can do for you what I've promised to do. I can restore you to God. The teacher, after his experiment, says there's nothing lastingly satisfying in this life. And Jesus steps in and says, that is absolutely true. There's lots of good and beautiful things that we can enjoy in this life, but nothing satisfies the deep soul ache that we have. Jesus says, only God can. And through me, you can be restored to God. I love this quote from Augustine, and we'll end with this. Thou hast made us thyself, O Lord, and our heart is restless until it finds its rest in thee. In God is rest, and without him is restlessness.